The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is about 2 o'clock in the afternoon of April the 30th, 2007. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Terrio is here, been waiting patiently. Senator McGuire, myself, Senator French. We are going to first take up today SB 128. We have the bill sponsor here. If you'd come forward, Ms. Osterman, and remind us where we were last time when we left off, just to refresh our recollections.
I'm Jenny Osterman, staff to Senator Don Olson. I'll just give you a quick overview of the bill. SB 128 came about at the urging of the Rural Justice Commission. This legislation is an integral part of the effort to regulate the sale, distribution, purchase, and shipment of alcoholic beverages into damp local option communities within the state of Alaska. It puts in place a requirement for the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board to create and maintain a database that contains up-to-date information related to written orders for alcohol shipped to the writer of the order. The package store licensee must consult the database prior to filling each order. Currently, AS0411150G regulates the amount of alcoholic beverages to residents of local option areas. SB 128 requires that the package store licensee, agent, or employee access the database to determine the amounts of alcoholic beverages already ordered by an individual. It also requires that the date and amount of the new order be immediately added to the database. This database will adversely impact the importation and sale of alcoholic beverages into rural Alaskan communities by bootleggers. The information in the database will be accessible only to package stores and law enforcement. None of the information would be available to the public. Senate Bill 128 also contains a provision to correct an omission in state law relative to the transfer of liquor licenses between an organized borough and communities in that borough. Many communities across the state have used their allotment of liquor licenses while their borough has not. Boroughs may now transfer alcoholic beverage licenses to those communities. And I know that you have an amendment for the bill, and we're happy to accept that amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Osterman. And just remind me, which is the section on the transfer of liquor licenses?
Just a moment. Let's go to my section. Sections 4 and 5.
And is there anything in those sections that requires those transfers to be done at fair market value? That is,
there's nothing that spells that out that I'm aware of.
Would there be an objection to adding a provision along those lines from the bill sponsor?
No.
Or from the Department of Law?
I would like to ask Doug Briggs about that, because I think that the chair.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, this is Annie Carpinetti. I'm concerned about that. I would like to talk to Doug Griffin, who's head of the ABC board, before putting that in, because Title IV really doesn't address commercial value of liquor licenses. And to my knowledge, it doesn't in any place. And I would be concerned adding it here without talking to the board and the staff to make sure that that is something that will work in our statutory scheme.
And does this bill go to finance after here?
Yes.
That may be the place to take care of that. Let's go back then to the amendment that we have on our desks, and that is amendment, I'm going to go ahead and style amendment number one. I'll make it by myself just for the record, and I'll offer it if someone would object for the purposes of discussion.
Object.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. The idea behind amendment number one is a result of the conversation we had last time. If you all may recall, there were imposing several new duties on liquor store clerks. There was some question about what the penalty or the level of the violation would be should the clerks not comport with the new duties we're giving them. And I believe Ms. Carpinetti was telling the committee just before the hearing began that an unauthorized release of information that's now going to be gathered into this database would be an A misdemeanor. Yes. And that's correct.
Yes, that's the default penalty for Title A violations is a Class A misdemeanor unless it's specifically accepted and another penalty is provided.
And on that point, just to read into the record, since you made this segue, so the way I'm interpreting it then is that Class A misdemeanor would be interpreted throughout Section 1. So it makes it very clear that except as otherwise specifically provided in this section, this is page 1, lines 11, the information contained in the database is confidential and not subject to inspection or copying under, and that the information in the database is only available to the following. So I'm interpreting that to mean that if somebody someone gained access to the database in an unauthorized manner, they would be subject to that Class A misdemeanor. If somebody who was authorized to have access to that database and used information in an unauthorized manner, that they would also be subject to that penalty. So in other words, I want it to be interpreted the most broadly in terms of preserving the confidentiality of that database.
That's how I interpret it also.
Any other more on that point? Senator McGuire, thank you for clearing that up. The amendment then just adds that a failure by a package store licensee, agent, or employee to enter into the database the date and amount of the alcoholic beverages shipped to the purchaser is a Class B misdemeanor. In this case, I think that would be a maximum of 90 days. And is it $5,000 or $1,000?
I think it's $1,000.
I think that's right. So there would be the potential for jail time and a fine for not entering the data as decreed by the statute we're putting into place. So that's the thrust of the amendment. I'm going to remove my objection. Or Senator McGuire, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection.
Thank you. You remove your objection. Is there further objection to amendment number one? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number one is adopted. That brings us back to the bill itself. Are there further questions, comments, or discussion amongst the committee members on the bill?
No.
Hearing and seeing none, is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move we move CS for Senate Bill number 128 as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved from this committee to the next. Let's take a short recess to do the paperwork. The Judiciary Committee will come back to order. Next up is SB 8 by Senators Davis, Ellis, and Elton. We have a representative from the prime sponsor. Good afternoon, Mr. Obermeyer. If you'd put yourself on the record, the committee would be eager to hear your testimony.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon. I'm Tom Obermeyer, legislative aide to Senator Davis. Concerning Senate Bill 8, which you have in your package, concerning a mental health patient's right to choose the gender of hospital staff providing intimate care in a mental health facility or hospital for the purpose of mental health treatment. The sponsor statement indicates that Senate Bill 8 provides that a mental patient 18 years of age or older who is receiving mental health treatment and being provided intimate care at a hospital shall have the right to care provided by a staff member who is the gender that the patient requests. Many of these patients have been traumatized by sexual and or physical abuse in the past, and they are very sensitive to being touched or assisted by hospital staff who provide intimate care because the experience may trigger from original abuse feelings of fear, helplessness, distress, humiliation, and loss of trust in staff. The supervisor or manager employed by a hospital shall post notice of this right in a conspicuous place so the patients know they may exercise this right when they're concerned about the gender of staff responsible for their intimate care. While it is understandable that a hospital may not always be able to comply with the requirement of choice of gender in all situations and requests due to staffing schedules and shortages on particular shifts or duty units, the bill requires that the facility document the noncompliance in the patient record. that the intimate care was provided by a licensed or unlicensed staff member of a gender opposite that requested by the patient. This information might otherwise be ignored or lost. The information is also useful not only for confirming the good faith effort on the part of the institution to comply with the wishes of the patient, but for medical purposes as well in evaluating the effect on patient outcome, because individuals re-traumatized in this way are subject to chronic stress, which can worsen serious mental illness and result in symptomatic relapses and repeated rehospitalizations. Lastly, the bill will preserve information for inquiry into grievance procedures at mental health facilities under Title 47, which have been described as unduly burdensome by some patients and easily circumvented or limited because the language is too broad. I bring to your attention, in addition to the sponsor statement in your package, a document that was just provided by the Disability Law Center today, April 30th, which is their written testimony concerning this bill. I bring your attention on page one after the cover page that this bill would codify existing rights of individuals receiving mental health treatment that are not currently acknowledged or protected. They draw your attention in the next paragraph to Alaska's Constitution, clearly recognizing the right to privacy as an important one under Article 1, Section 22. Then they draw your attention to two cases of import. The first one indicates from Michigan that although there will be a certain relinquishment of privacy by necessity when anyone is admitted to a mental health facility, that does not mean that the patient has forfeited all rights to privacy. And they reiterate something in another case 6 years later, citing that former case. Furthermore, sensitivity to the privacy rights of individuals receiving mental health treatment might further treatment goals of some individuals. And then finally, I thought it was very interesting that they note that in many circumstances, the type of privacy protections provided in Senate Bill 8 are already available to individuals incarcerated in correctional institutions. They point out that patients are not convicted criminals, but instead are there as a result of civil commitments. Thus, their right to privacy may not be abrogated by virtue of their confinement in a state-run facility, unlike a prison inmate who has forfeited some rights in repayment to society. The last document I'd like to draw your attention to is the one from the Department of Health and Social Services Advisory Board on Alcohol and Drug Abuse, dated April 16th, from Andrea Schmuck, chair, who may be online today. She indicates that the Mental Health Board strongly supports the notion that patients in psychiatric hospitals should have the right to choose gender in the person providing intimate care. It will allow the individual to retain their dignity during a time of extreme stress and vulnerability and afford a modicum of choice and control in a fundamentally uncontrollable situation. She points out that this bill has been criticized as unnecessary because hospitals should be allowed to handle this issue administratively through internal policies and procedures. But the Alaska Mental Health Board was instrumental in convincing API, Alaska Psychiatric Institute, to promote such a policy and applauds their efforts. But the board believes a single isolated policy is not sufficient to safeguard the rights of all individuals who find themselves in an acute psychiatric facility. Placing this provision into statute will ensure that patients in API and the state of Alaska designated evaluation and treatment beds, as well as those in private psychiatric facilities, will be afforded this basic right. The Mental Health Board is also sensitive to the argument that the provisions will create a financial burden on psychiatric hospitals by forcing staff so as to have both genders available to patients at all times. But the language found in this, and I correct them, it says in the CS, there is no CS to Senate Bill 8, clearly provides a method dealing with this issue. If the patient cannot be served by someone of the gender they choose, the hospital must simply document that a request was made and that it was not to be honored, not able to be honored. As such, this bill will not impact the bottom line of for hospitals, and you may note also in the record in your documents that there is a zero fiscal note on this particular bill. Finally, this bill offers a balance between the rights of the patient for privacy and choice and the physician's duty to provide sound, responsible care. If the treating psychiatrist determines that the choice made by the patient is not in the best interest of the patient's treatment, he or she may override a patient's choice.
Thank you, Mr. Obermeyer. Questions for Mr. Obermeyer? Senator McGuire.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Obermeyer. First of all, I support the bill. I have, for many years, I've seen this bill introduced, and I think it's a really important provision in law if we could ever get it through. But my question, and I can't remember this from earlier versions, page 1, line 7, we say that a patient 18 years of age or older who's receiving mental health treatment, and I'm just wondering, I can't remember, how are minors treated? Do you know?
I don't know, and that struck me also. Okay. And I think there are probably people online that could answer that.
I just wouldn't want to exclude them.
I think that's a very good question.
Senator Terry, I'll ask a question.
Thank you. Can you tell me, this is specifically to people who have mental health issues, are we affording them a more higher privacy right than somebody that's in a hospital setting for just medical care?
Through the chair, yes, Senator Terrio, only in the regard that the rights can be easily abrogated in an involuntary commitment, and that tends to be one of the issues that has arisen many, many times. In fact, there were two recent cases brought by Attorney James Gottstein in Anchorage. One is the Weatherthorne case, I believe, and another one was the Faith Myers case, which addresses some of the particular issues that occur, particularly as a due process rights. Many of these people have no ability to grieve what they think is a violation of one type or another. And in this particular case, the right to privacy, if they request a person of the opposite gender, often it's just it either is ignored or not documented and nothing ever happens. And there's no way of really clearly providing that or a record of that request. This bill should address that.
And Mr. Chairman, one other case question here. They can request a member who is the gender that the patient requests. What if you have a male inmate or a patient who requests a female?
Well, it could be, through the chair, again, Senator Terrio, it could be that this person could have been sexually abused by a person of the same sex would feel more comfortable with a person of the opposite sex. There are unusual circumstances, particularly relating to mental health patients, that cause additional concern in this regard that you wouldn't find in normal hospital settings. So it'd be hard for me to anticipate why, but that's the reason it was drafted in this fashion.
Let me ask a follow-up question, and maybe this is something that I'll just let the committee know that Ron Adler from the API Division of Behavioral Health is on the line to answer questions, so some of these may be better aimed at him. But I would just ask whether there's anything in the bill that requires a nurse of either sex to endanger him or herself in providing care, or put him or herself into a spotty position. You know, I think Senator Terrio maybe raises the possibility that a mentally imbalanced patient might be asking for a member of the opposite sex for their own bad reasons.
Senator French, I would anticipate that in this type of arrangement, the mental health facility knows whether a person has a propensity toward violence or what their particular problems are before they would acknowledge this request. And if that particular person they felt might be putting one of the staff members at risk, we'll say a female staff member, they might post another male staff member outside the door for the security of that person if they wanted intimate care from the female staff.
Or send two females.
Or some other issue.
Why don't we ask Mr. Adler? Any other questions for Mr. Obermeier? Thank you so much for being here. We do have Mr. Adler on the line. Mr. Adler, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Did you hear the last couple of questions?
Yes, I did.
Can you put yourself on the record, please, and offer us your thoughts on those subjects?
Sure. My name is Ron Adler, and I'm the CEO of Alaska Psychiatric Institute, which is operated by the Division of Behavioral Health and the Department of Health and Social Services. Through the chair, generally the treating psychiatrist in the assessment phase of any kind of an acute care inpatient stay would generally understand if there are issues related to intimate care. And the bill covers this very well, by the way. If there are extenuating circumstances where it would be to the patient's detriment in any way, shape or form, then the treating psychiatrist would simply override that with the doctor's order.
And the only thing that the bill requires you to do in that case is simply document the decision. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. Senator Terrio has a question.
But what if the patient, part of their particular situation is that they derive some perverse pleasure from, you know, the particular care from a certain gender? Would that be something that would be detrimental to the patient's care, the, you know, feeding that potential perversion?
Through the chair, absolutely. And, again, that would be an issue that would – let me just take you through the admissions process. First of all, in every hospitalization, whether it's at API or at one of the DET facilities around the state, there's an admission screening process, which is the beginning of a comprehensive psychiatric evaluation. Then, after someone is admitted to a unit, there is usually a nursing assessment which happens. And probably within 24 hours, there's a medical, either a nurse practitioner or a medical doctor that does a history and physical. And after that point, generally the patient is evaluated by both a psychiatrist and a social worker. And if there are any contraindications or around intimate care, it usually comes out in that assessment and evaluation period. And absolutely, a psychiatrist would pick up on that and do what's in the patient's best therapeutic interest.
Does that answer your question, Senator Terrio?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Adler.
Okay.
We have, and if you'd remain on the line for other questions that may arise, and that's very helpful. Thank you for being here
sure.
This afternoon. We do have four folks from the public signed up to testify, and we'll go ahead and turn now to the public testimony. We would begin in Anchorage. We have Faith Meyer, Dorrance Collins, and Jim Gottstein all set up to testify. If you could each come forward one at a time to the mic, put yourselves on the record. We'd be happy to hear your testimony. Perhaps if you could keep your testimony to about 3 minutes, that'd be probably the best use of the committee's time. Thank you. Faith Myers, are you there?
Yes, this is Faith Myers, and my testimony will be about 3.5 minutes.
That's wonderful, Ms. Myers. Thanks for being here.
I support the passing of Senate Bill 8 as written. I have an avocation in mental health advocacy. In the past, I have been in acute care psychiatric facilities as a patient in Alaska, Washington, and Nevada. Also, as an advocate, I have contacted psychiatric hospital administrators in Maine, Maryland, Nevada, Alaska, and Washington looking for best practices. There is such a thing as unnecessary traumatization of psychiatric patients in a psychiatric facility, especially in facilities in states that look for shortcuts. It is the rules and statutes of the state that reduce the amount of trauma and recidivism. We fully understand the idea of a psychiatric emergency when gender choice may not be able to be provided. What we want to reduce is the unnecessary traumatization of a psychiatric patient who is reasonably cooperative. The percentage of women in acute care psychiatric facilities who have a history of sexual abuse and/or physical abuse in their past is somewhere between 51% and 98%, respectively. The figure for men is a little bit less. To a person with mental illness, it is certain he or she feels re-victimized when he or she is given intimate care against their will by a gender of the person who sexually abused them in the past. There are 3 or 4 hospitals that do civil commitments in Alaska, and there are numerous other ones that do 3-day evaluations that stretch out into 7 days. This issue cannot be dealt with by working to change each hospital's policy. Change needs to be done by state statute. I would like to briefly explain the support letters in favor of a bill for gender choice of staff for intimate care. The following letters of support should have been provided to you. 1. Anne F. Jennings, Ph.D., trauma-informed systems consultant, has background knowledge of trauma in acute care psychiatric facilities. She also has a personal connection. Her daughter was in and out of psychiatric institutions from the age of 13 to 32 when her daughter committed suicide in a psychiatric institution. 2. Erin S. Wolf, MD, MMD. Dr. Wolf has over 30 years of experience in treating psychiatric patients from children to adults. 3. Nami Anchorage. Their board members have personally been in psychiatric institutions and had family members in psychiatric institutions. 4. Alaska Mental Health Consumer Web. Their board members also have a wide range of experience with psychiatric facilities. 5. The Alaska Mental Health Board. 6. Disability Law Center. 7. Psychiatric Rights. All told, there are probably 50 or more board members that voted that a gender choice of staff for intimate care bills should be passed, many of them experts in the field. Senate Bill 8 only requires psychiatric institutions to make a good faith effort at giving gender choice of staff. In closing, I am asking you to pass Senate Bill 8. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Myers. Next up is Doris Collins. Doris, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record, and we'd be eager to hear your testimony.
All right, Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Doris Collins. I support the passing of Senate Bill 8 as written. Post-traumatic stress disorder is one of the most prevalent and costly mental illnesses in America. Not giving gender choice of staff for intimate care in inpatient settings is traumatic to many psychiatric patients and can add to the illness. In other states, some psychiatric facilities take providing gender choice of staff for intimate care seriously. These facilities have policies that require the facility to schedule a portion of their workforce by gender. As an example, if there are 5 male staff on one unit and 5 female staff on another unit, policy would require the head nurse, when scheduling, to see to it there are sufficient men and women staff on each shift to provide gender choice. Also, in larger hospitals with multiple units, if the required gender is not available for intimate care, facility policy would require staff to go to the next unit to try and find the requested gender. Units are often just separated by a door. These are all policies that we have been informed that Alaska psychiatric hospitals and facilities will not adopt. Even when it is pointed out that adopting such policies does not cost money and reduces trauma. In a recent Alaska Supreme Court decision, the justices stated, there is a clear, unavoidable tension between hospitals seeking convenience economics and patient rights, which can manifest itself in patient abuse. The justices saw it as a given that psychiatric hospitals and units were going to take shortcuts and would, without regulations, deny psychiatric patients their rights. It is the laws passed by the legislature and the action taken by the courts that will force psychiatric hospitals to do the right thing. Almost without exception, those patients entering an acute care psychiatric facility have dementia and trauma in their background, and to a lesser extent, those patients entering evaluation facilities. Many have been victimized, some from childhood through adulthood. The percentage that have been sexually abused and physically abused is much higher than the rate in the general society. When psychiatric patients are not given gender choice, they feel they're being re-victimized all over again. As a civilized society, we can't leave psychiatric patient protection up to guesswork. We need to pass statutes. Passing Senate Bill 8 will give back to psychiatric patients a small amount of dignity and control they lost when entering a psychiatric facility. Senate Bill 8 only asks that psychiatric institutions make a good faith effort at providing gender choice of staff for intimate care. Adding more loopholes for psychiatric facilities to utilize will make the bill less effective. In closing, I'm asking you to pass Senate Bill 8 as written. Thank you.
Mr. Collins, thank you. That was a good statement. Next up is Jim Gottstein. Mr. Gottstein, are you on the line?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead and put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
You bet. Thank you. Yes, I'm Jim Gottstein. I'm president and CEO of the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights, often known as Psych Rights. Its mission is to mount a strategic litigation campaign against forced psychiatric drugging, and Mr. Obermeyer mentioned the first two cases in that. That we took, which resulted in favorable Alaska Supreme Court decisions. But that's not really what SB 8 is about, but I wanted to come by and really add my voice to those supporting SB 8. It's I really can't, I think, improve on the statements of Mr. Obermeyer, Ms. Myers, and Mr. Collins, but I do want to add my voice to theirs. It really is a question of basic human dignity to allow people this kind of choice. And it's a simple thing to do. It doesn't cost anything. And there's really no reason not to do it, in my view. You've heard about the issue of trauma, and that's a very, very serious issue. People come into the hospital. They're uniformly very frightened. And to have someone give them intimate care that causes them to relive a trauma in their past really is extremely counter-therapeutic. And there's, I think there's no reason not to accommodate their requests when it can be done. So I urge you all to pass SB 8 out of the committee favorably and move it on for final passage. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gottstein. Any questions for Mr. Gottstein? I don't see any, sir. Thank you again for participating in the committee this afternoon. We have one other person signed up to testify, and that's Andrea Schmuck from the Alaska Mental Health Board. Ms. Schmuck, can you hear me?
Hello?
Yes, Ms. Schmuck.
Yes.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record, and the committee will listen to your testimony.
Okay. This is Andrea Schmuck. I'm chair of the Alaska Mental Health Board, and I'm also a recovered mental patient. I just want to add my personal support to the passage of Senate Bill 8 as well. A few years back, for 6.5 years, I was director for the Office of Consumer Affairs for the state of Illinois for the Division of Mental Health. In that capacity, I was involved in the national organization of those of us who were in offices of consumer affairs. And in a meeting in Florida, we discussed the very issues that we're talking about today, and that is sexual abuse of both males and females. And what, as a result of that sexual abuse, is children becoming into the mental health system as children and adults. We discussed some of the very things that today we're discussing about the need for people to have their gender choices to be accepted and to have the right to some sort of dignity when you're faced with being in the inpatient setting. Some of the people that we were discussing this with were people that had been in the system and had been in restraint, and talking about how that was one of the things that gave them flashbacks to what had happened to them as children and how detrimental it was to their mental health and to relapse. So I just want to say once again that I am here to support this bill on a personal basis besides being chair of the Mental Health Board. Thank you very much.
Ms. Schmuck, thank you. Thank you for being here. Any questions for Ms. Schmuck? I don't see any. Is anyone else online that would like to testify on behalf of the bill? Anybody else here in the room that would like to testify on behalf of the bill? Mr. Obermeyer.
I just had one more comment. If Senator French, if Mr. Agler is still on the line, he might be able to answer the question that Senator McGuire asked concerning the age of the individuals that in the bill.
Mr. Agler, are you on the line, and do you remember the question?
I don't remember. I am on the line, and I don't remember the question.
Go ahead, Senator McGuire.
So my question was on page 1 in line 7 of the bill. It says that this bill essentially will apply to patients 18 years of age or older who are receiving mental health treatment. And I wondered if you might know how minors are treated or how they would be treated as a result of excluding them from the bill.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, generally a minor that's admitted to an inpatient unit has a guardian or parental consent. And, you know, if it's the guardian and or parent that would resolve an issue like this.
Okay, so I guess just in follow-up through the chair, so are you saying it raises age of majority issues if we were to leave it simply a patient and not specify 18 years or older? So that
through the chair, Senator McGuire, I think, and I'm not certain of this, but when this issue came up last year regarding this specific legislation, I'm pretty sure North Star Behavioral Health Hospital built a case that state statutes do not override parental consent. But I would have to ask the bill sponsor to go do some homework on that with law. And it seemed to have the objections that they raised seemed to have made sense. And again, I'm sorry, I don't know what they were. And I'm quickly looking through my last year electronic file on this bill, and I can't seem to find it. I can't seem to find what that objection was.
Okay, so I appreciate that. And through the chair, I guess I would just then ask the Mr. Obermeyer to look into it, because I could envision a circumstance, for example, where perhaps you had a minor who was being sexually abused by their parent, or I wouldn't necessarily think it'd be their guardian, but let's say by their parent. They have mental health problems. They're in a mental health setting, and let's say they're a young woman that's 16, and they don't wish to have intimate care provided by a male because they've been sexually abused, and perhaps their abuser says, "I don't care." So who's their advocate then? So I don't know. I personally would feel more comfortable not specifying an age and simply leaving it to a patient and letting it sort itself out. Unless I hear compelling reason otherwise.
I am thinking along the same lines that you are, Senator McGuire. And I guess one easy thought would be at least to lower the age to 16. What would happen if we put the age down to 16, where we grant folks, I mean, basically it's the age of consent in Alaska. Yeah. That's the point when you can make mature decisions about your own body for yourself. Mr. Adler, would that create any problems for your institution if we put the age at 16?
I would have to research that with law, and I'd be glad to do that.
Maybe we could put it to 16 and then let the Finance Committee figure out if there's a huge bump in the road. Yeah. So for Amendment Number 1, I'm going to move that we, on page 1, line 7, change the age 18 down to 16. Is there objection to that amendment? Hearing and seeing none, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. And then that just leaves the issue of parents and guardians of patients under the age of 16. Senator McGuire, do you want to offer an amendment, or do you want, you're going to let that go for the time being?
Yep.
Other questions, comments from the committee members for Mr. Adler while we have him on the line? Mr. Adler, do you have any closing remarks you want to give us about your institution's perspective on the bill?
Through the chair, Mr. Obermeyer, I think that API has listened intently to Dorrance Collins, Faith Myers, and Andrea Schmuck. And I think, in theory, many of the things that that they're advocating are certainly leading us in the right direction. My only concern about this legislation, which is the same concern that I had last year, is that the patient record really shouldn't be used to document anything on a compliance issue. We've heard Mr. Gottstein state that the prime the mission for psych rights is litigation, reforming the system, mental health care system, through litigation. And I think when you document noncompliance in a patient record, which really isn't part of their treatment plan, you're just opening the door for potential litigation. I think that there should be an alternate way for hospitals to document noncompliance. At API, we use something called an unusual occurrence report. That would be my only input into the bill as it is written.
Mr. Adler, thank you for those thoughts, and I guess I would just say that you've seen the legislation in the past. You've got the legislation in front of you now. If you were to suggest language to the bill sponsor or to the, one of the committees that are going to see this bill after this one, I'm sure they'd give your idea a full vetting. It sounds like a reasonable idea, but we don't have language in front of us to work on. Mr. Obermeyer.
Senator French, in response to that, the sponsor statement anticipated this and indicated that this information is useful not only for confirming the good faith effort but to comply with the wishes of the patient, but for the medical purposes as well in the patient record in evaluating the effect on patient outcome, because individuals re-traumatized in this way are subject to chronic stress and can worsen mental illness and symptomatic relapses and repeated rehospitalizations. The real issue here is the fact that patient records are going to be maintained permanently, and yes, for litigation purposes in some areas. And unlike some other type of unusual circumstance or other documentation, this type of thing may not be preserved. But the medical record is useful for that purpose, but it's also useful for the medical personnel to see if repeated refusal to allow a person to have the choice of gender has affected their outcome, that they've been rehospitalized, that they're not getting better, and so forth. So I think it has a useful purpose in that regard.
Senator McGuire with a follow-up.
Well, and just in wrap-up, I wanted to wait until Senator Terrio came back, but just in response, I think the question that he asked at the outset of the hearing was, is this a right that we're giving to mental health patients that other patients don't have? And I would just respectfully disagree that, you know, this is one of the state functions. People in our community who are mentally ill don't choose that path. They end up on that road, and it's incumbent on us as the state to protect them as best we can when they have to be involuntarily committed in particular. And intimate care is a very personal issue, and for most of us who are not mentally ill, we do make those choices. And as women, we get that opportunity to make the choice of who we want to be our OBGYN, for example. And I will tell you that is an issue that is very important to many women. And so I think this bill is important, and with all due respect to Mr. Adler, I would just submit that it's this bill's existence, this very bill's existence every year, and the folks who have written the letters to the editor and put themselves on the line that have forced API to change their policies, and I think that's a healthy direction that they've headed in. But I, with all due respect, I don't know, and I can't submit whether they would have gone in that direction voluntarily. So I think this is all a really healthy, important public process that we're going through to try and continue to focus on the rights of the mentally ill in our community.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. Further debate or discussion amongst the committee members? Hearing and seeing none, we've closed public testimony. We've heard from the bill sponsor. Are there further amendments to Senate Bill Number 8? Senator Terry, well, in your absence, we lowered the age to 16 on line 7.
And Mr. Chairman, one other question for the spokesman for the bill sponsor. As far as the hospital staff keeping a record, keeping the charts up, what kind of penalty is there for not adequately documenting that?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, there's no penalty for this. It's a matter of documentation, and the documentation is what's going to provide the protection later on rather than penalties. The protection would be afforded because medical doctors, psychiatrists can look at the record and see if this person has been violated, or that that they have not, they've had their rights abrogated through the process of recording that they've never been afforded choice of gender. And and in this case, it's certainly going to help also, I think, over a period of time to encourage the facilities to give these people the right to choose their gender, because they're going to recognize that this is a permanent record, not a temporary document that can be lost or discarded at some point.
Okay, so if the patient's wishes are disregarded, and you know, somebody that is of the opposite gender than what they wished performs services, does it set up a potential civil claim against the institution for not keeping proper documentation that
through the chair of Senator Terrio? It doesn't set up any litigation. It's just a matter of evidence that an attorney could look into later that might not otherwise be available at that time.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments following up on that point? Is there a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill number 8 as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill is moved from committee. We'll take a short recess to do the paperwork. We're back on the record. The Judiciary Committee will now hear take up CS for Senate Bill 145. We have the bill's prime sponsor, Senator McGuire, here. Senator McGuire, we turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. First of all, I want to point out that this bill would implement an option that could be used, a tool, if you will, in the tool belt of municipalities in the state. Just to clarify that on the record, that if there's any confusion that we're forcing municipalities and taking away local control, we're not. We're simply giving the option to local municipalities as to whether or not they want to set up procedures by which they impound and forfeit vehicles for those individuals in their municipality who have amassed $1,000 or more in delinquent traffic fines. And Mr. Chairman, this bill was brought to me by our municipality of Anchorage, which I will use just for reference. I don't have figures for other municipalities, but the municipality of Anchorage today currently has $7.57 million in unpaid fines. And those fines are made up by just over 1,000 people. So it's really 1,017 individuals in our community who make up that group of individuals who simply thumb their nose, frankly, at the law, don't pay their fines, and don't feel they need to. One person in our community has 43 citations totaling $9,310. Another has 70 different traffic citations totaling close to $8,000 in unpaid fines. This law is meant to allow municipalities to target habitual repeat offenders, who time after time again violate traffic laws, blatantly disregard public safety, and refuse to pay citation fines. Many of these offenders refuse to pay their fines because they simply know the municipality has little or no recourse to collect those fines. So the Anchorage Assembly has unanimously passed an ordinance on the same issue, and under that a new ordinance, it would be a misdemeanor under our local law for anyone who has at least 3 unpaid traffic tickets worth $1,000 or more in Anchorage to drive. But this bill provides another tool in the tool belt. It has no impact fiscally on the state of Alaska. Again, it would just be a tool for those that wanted to go ahead and use it. And what would happen is individuals who are stopped by a police officer who ran their license plate and found that they had over 1,000 in tickets, they would lose their vehicle for 30 days. In order for the individual to get their vehicle back, they'd have to pay $390 in administrative fees plus towing and storage fees. And so the goal, of course, as I have said in prior hearings, and I think you're well aware, Mr. Chairman, the SCOF law bill has been around for a while. We've been looking at this concept. Is meant to serve as a deterrent. It's meant to encourage people to timely pay their traffic violations and to get people's attention. And it's also meant to help remind members of our community that it's simply not acceptable that others of us pay our fines and some others, in this case just a little over 1,000 people, can sort of sit back to the tune of $7.5 million and not pay those fines while the rest of us are forced to absorb those costs through other things. The other part of the bill that we added in community and regional affairs is a requirement that the Department of Labor, and I have an amendment to Mr. Chairman that's in front of members, not to get out ahead of it, but that the department will allow a municipal attorney assist them in tracking down individuals who do have civil or criminal fines or penalties. And right now, there has been tremendous difficulty on the part of the municipality in getting that cooperation. And what we'd like to do is have a written agreement that the municipality enters into with the Department of Labor that would specify the purpose of the information, a description of the information provided, and the procedure for transmitting, securing, using, or disposing of the information, and then the method of reimbursement for the cost of providing that information. But questions that were asked on this in CNRA centered around, you know, why this would be a useful tool, and frankly, I think you know as a former prosecutor, Mr. Chairman, that people who have amassed these type of fines might fall into categories where they skip around in terms of employment and frankly are difficult to track down. Department of Labor is the place that is going to be most going to have more of that information, most apt to have that information that would be needed. And so this is an effort to ask them to cooperate with our municipality to help track those individuals down. So just two things. One is mandatory and one is voluntary. One is optional.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. Questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Terrio and then Senator Wilikowski.
I'm sorry, you said the number of people that owe the $7 million.
Roughly, and these are the figures that I have in front of me that were given to me by the Muni, 1,017.
Okay. So that's like $6,500 per person. Which is amazing to me.
I came up with $7,000 each. That does strike me as being.
And I'm just wondering, Senator McGuire, do you
there is a list of them. There should be at least in your packet.
Is
your
there
perusal.
Any information from the municipality about the value of the vehicles that are being driven?
Yeah, we got into that discussion through the chair, Senator Terrio. We did get into that discussion a little bit in CNRA. And again, the point of the bill isn't necessarily value for value. So in other words, somebody could be driving around in a clunker that's, you know, worth $1,000 or less, and they may choose that taking their vehicle to them is less of an infringement than paying that penalty. That's their choice. But really what it's meant to do is get their attention, and that's what SCOF laws do. It's meant to set you back and get your attention in a very real way to put you in between yourself and your vehicle.
Okay.
So it's not necessarily the logic doesn't necessarily flow that it's the value amount of your car as it relates to the citation, but rather that it's meant to get your attention.
Okay. So if one of these people is my next door neighbor, do I have to be careful that I'm loaning them my car?
Yes, you do. Yes, you do, through the chair. And we got into that discussion. The preacher's wife was used as a great example. And one of the things that was brought up again, and you see this, and we deal with this in the DUI statutes. And I would point out that this is adding to the ability of local governing authorities to adopt ordinances. They're already allowed to adopt ordinances with respect to impoundment and forfeiture for vehicles that have been used for DUI offenses and suspended driving while you have a suspended driver's license. So we're adding on to that set of tools. But back to that same theory that underlies that is that, yes, there may be those unusual circumstances, but in the end, we're hoping that people are going to be more careful about who they lend their vehicle to. And we truly are trying to set up a situation where it's a deterrent. Now, there will be a process by which the local governing authority is going to have to set up a procedure of notice. Obviously, you know, Senatorio, you can't simply take somebody's property without notice and all those things. So I could envision that a reasonable appeal could be made if you were the preacher's wife and you had lent your vehicle to somebody. I think there might be reasonable circumstances that could be argued there. But
thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. The new section R that you have in section one there, that only applies to municipalities. That wouldn't apply to, say, boroughs or villages or other perhaps legally designated forms of government? No.
No. The bill only, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, this bill only applies to municipalities, and it has the definition that's given in the statute.
Are we going to hear from? Does the Department of Labor have an opinion on this? Are they okay with this provision?
We've got
Let's listen.
We've got someone from the Department of Labor. We've got someone from the Attorney General's office, and we have four people signed up from the Municipality of Anchorage to give us their perspective. Not to short circuit the discussion, but
yeah.
Yep. In fact, why don't we start with the Department of Labor, Ms. Scavera. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear your views on the bill.
For the record, my name is Paula Scavera. I'm Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. With me online, actually, is Larry McKinstry, who is the attorney that represents the department on this issue. And some of your questions may be more applicable to him. I'm just here for questions, not really testimony on the bill.
Then let's turn to question for Ms. Scavera.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming that, I saw a fiscal note in here for a couple hundred thousand dollars, and is that for this new section?
Yes, it is, sir. I might note that the first 2 years we have it in general fund because we won't have any receipts. The way the bill is written, whatever costs will be paid for by the municipality. In a receipt kind of thing.
Is there any legal type of hurdles that you need to overcome that you're aware of to provide this information to municipal government?
Well, through the chair, Senator, we have actually worked with Senator McGuire's office to come up with an amendment. Because last September, there was some new regulations put into place by the federal government, and it actually gives steps that you have to follow to trade information. And so we've, Larry McKinstry can speak more to the amendment that we did to the CRA amendment.
I guess before we get to that, is the Department of Labor providing information to any other non-state agency or organization?
Well, actually, sir, through many programs that we do grants with, and by federal law, we actually have to give information to child support, et cetera. There are instances who by federal and state law we have to give information to. But Mr. McKinstry can go into more detail than I can.
Thank you.
Why don't we do that? Why don't we turn to Mr. McKinstry, because I think we're on legal questions about the bill. Mr. McKinstry, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
And if you just go ahead and put yourself on the record, we've got a couple questions for you. Thank you.
Very good. My name is Larry McKinstry. I'm an assistant attorney general at the state, and I represent the Department of Labor.
And I think Senator Wilikowski's last question was about whether the Department of Labor is currently supplying information about its records to entities outside of government. I think that was the question.
Well, through the chair, the problem with disclosure of this type of information is that it's governed not only by our own state statute, but also by federal regulation, which Ms. Guevara mentioned was modified last September in 2006. The regulations are relatively complex and cover a whole host of different exceptions, but the general rule is that wage information and unemployment information is confidential, and it's held by the department solely for the purposes of administration of the unemployment insurance benefit program, except for, as I mentioned, there are a number of exceptions that are set out both in our state statute and in the federal regulations. So we do, in fact, we are mandated by federal law to give up information to certain entities under the federal regulations, and we are also somewhat mandated under our own statute to at least look at whether or not we disclose information to other entities within the state. But anything that the state gives up pursuant to the state statute has to also comply with the federal regulations. And so it's a somewhat complex problem of trying to figure out, you know, whether or not a specific requester or a specific type of information falls within one of those written exceptions.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. I'm looking at this is under Chapter 20 of the Alaska Employment Security Act, and the very first sentence of that act defines what the purpose of that act is, and it says, "This chapter shall be liberally construed to accomplish its purposes to promote employment security by increasing opportunities for placement through the maintenance of a system of public employment offices, et cetera, et cetera." Are we promoting employment security through this provision that we're adding here, in your opinion?
Through the chair, I guess I don't quite understand the thrust of your question. By disclosing this type of information, typically the statute would hold this confidential unless it's being used for unemployment purposes. But again, there are a whole host of exceptions, and this would be creating a new exception for the use for collection, for fines, and for civil judgments. The way it's drafted as it stands would also include any type of civil judgment. So we're actually broadening the scope of the purpose that the use would be made of this information.
Looking at the first section, the new proposed section 110R, it says, "The department shall provide information obtained under this chapter to a municipal attorney." What kind of information are we talking about that you'll be turning over to the municipal attorney?
I think, through the chair, the type of information that we're talking about specifically is the name, address, and the identifying information of the employer for each employee, so that the municipalities can then take that information and have an easier job of finding, you know, the person who's got the outstanding tickets or has the judgment against them, so that they can go and either attach wages or collect on those judgments.
So it's just the name and address of the employee?
As far as I understand, through the chair, as far as I understand, that's the thrust of the use of the information that's being sought.
And if you, how quickly do you assume that you'll have to provide that information under this section? Is within a week or a month or a year? And that's question one. And question two is, do you see that if you fail to provide information, do you see that the state could be liable from a municipality for that failure?
Through the chair, as to the first question, I would assume that the discussions that I understand is that there's been some talk about an ongoing type of request that's set up through a database kind of exchange between the municipality and the state, the department. And as to the second question, in terms of liability exposure, what's going to have to happen for all of this flow to take place is that there'll have to be a written agreement between the division and the municipality, and under the terms of that agreement, it's going to have to comply with all the requirements, restrictions, limitations, whatnot, of the federal regulations. And so that should, in fact, protect the state from any potential liability. Should the information be denied, I think the municipality would have to institute some sort of lawsuit or some sort of process to try and get the state to give up the information if it were not provided. But under the terms of the statute, I think once the database is set up, it would be a pretty much straightforward exchange of information.
And just one last question, Mr. Chair. The on page 2, line 1 and 2, it talks about there must, within that agreement, be a method of reimbursement for the cost of providing the information. So presumably we should have a zero fiscal note on that. Is that fair to say? Because
yes.
Ms. Escobar.
Through the chair, if I can respond to that, maybe Ms. Guevara could actually respond to that question more fully than I can. But my understanding is that in order to set up the database exchange and to do the programming that would be necessary for that and to set up the agreements, the written agreements, there's going to be significant upfront costs. Once the process gets set up and there's a methodology set up for reimbursement or payment for the exchange of information, then that should cover the long-term cost. But, under the federal regulations, the federal government, the United States Department of Labor, has made it very clear that this is a state cost if the information is being provided to someone other than for unemployment purposes. It's a state cost that has to be carried by the state. So all of those costs would have to be covered either through state general funds or through some sort of funds from the municipality.
Okay, so despite the fact that there's a fiscal note of $205,000 going out through FY 2013, you're saying that you intend to be reimbursed for that full amount? Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, again, I'm not the one who deals with the financial side of this thing, but my understanding is that those costs are for staffing costs to maintain the database, to make sure that the exchange occurs when it's supposed to occur, and to cover the accounting costs and all of those other types of things that go along with this informational exchange.
Raising her hand.
Ms. Guevara.
Through the chair, the way the fiscal note is provided is the first 2 years we have program receipts, and then after that it is all statutory designated receipts, which would be money we take in. It's going to take money to do the memorandums of agreements with municipalities, and it's going to take money to set up the system, and we cannot spend one federal dollar to do it. So the way we've designed the fiscal note is 2 years of general fund, and then after that it will be statutory designated receipts.
Senator Terrio.
But we just had some testimony that there would be some upfront costs and then the costs would come down, and that doesn't seem to be reflected here. And it seems to me that why can't you start out with statutory designated program receipts? You enter into the agreement with municipality, they pay the money, and then you start the work. If they don't pay the money, you don't do the work.
Well, we actually have to have the work started before we enter into agreement with them, through the chair, because we have to have money to pay for lawyers before we can even start this whole stuff. And part of the cost is we're going to have two people full-time, one person who's going to work approximately 1 month a year to do these different disclosures, because as the system comes on board, more municipalities are going to want to do it. The municipality of Anchorage would like to do it now, this very moment, but that doesn't mean the municipality of Juneau or other municipalities aren't going to jump online, and they have to have memorandums, separate memorandums of agreement.
We do have four individuals signed up from the municipality of Anchorage that wanted to testify. Are you gentlemen still on the line?
Still with us.
Still with us.
The municipality's here.
We are running tight on time. Here's what I'm going to do. We're going to have to hold this bill over, and we will give you a day's notice about when we're going to bring it up next so that you can testify. But we're 10 after right now, and committee members have other obligations this afternoon. So I regret not being able to get to you. I apologize for keeping you there. But we just are running up into a time crunch. So without any further matters to come before the committee, we're going to stand in adjournment.